From the capital city this week, I'm Joey Peters.
I'm Matthew Reichbach.
And it's the Weekly Word. Today we're going to have Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance. We're going to talk about drugs.
Talk about some of the bills they have going here in the legislative session, from marijuana to some anti-overdose measures that look really interesting.
And later on, we'll have more updates of my IPRA, or public records request, troubles with the governor's office.
Yeah, we need to get theme music for the saga of the Santa Fe reporters' IPRA problems. But we'll have that just after this. But right after this break, we'll have Emily on. And we're back. I'm Matthew Reichbach with the Mexico Telegram.
And I'm Joey Peters with the Santa Fe Reporter. We're here with Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance. Emily, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Absolutely. I want to start with, just tell us a little bit about what the Drug Policy Alliance is. What kind of legislation are you here in the Roundhouse advocating for?
So we are a policy advocacy organization here in New Mexico, and we have offices in other states around the country. But our focus is really about ending the war on drugs and advocating for policies that reduce the harms of prohibition, but also reduce the harms of drug misuse. So we're focusing on trying to reduce our overdose rates and marijuana reform.
So overdose rates are, New Mexico, some of the highest in the nation?
We lead the nation in overdose deaths.
All like prescription and illegal drugs?
That's right. Prescription and illegal drugs, we have the highest rate. In fact, it's over 2 times the national rate. And if you look at counties in northern New Mexico, it's 5 times the national rate.
So, and you have a couple of, in Rio Riba, you have a couple of bills that would address a little bit of prevention, right? And what are those?
Well, there's a life-saving drug that a lot of people don't know about, and it's called naloxone, and it reverses an overdose. And it's incredible. And medical professionals aren't the only ones who can administer it. We can teach our families and our friends how to save a life. And we're trying to advocate that it's in everyone's medicine cabinet around this state.
So reduce an overdose, like, as it happens. How does this...
So do you remember Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, I was just thinking of that.
Yeah, so they now make it in a nasal form, so it's not the needle, which we all remember from the movie.
I only saw Pulp Fiction last year for the first time, so it's still fresh in my memory.
Yeah, well, just for a perspective, there's an overdose scene where they inject, I think, adrenaline into her heart. But that's not what this is quite.
No, it's not quite that, but it's very similar. So with someone can administer a nasal drug, and someone wakes up from an overdose immediately. And we have saved thousands and thousands of lives here in New Mexico with the drug naloxone. So we are advocating to appropriate some additional funds to the Department of Health so we can get naloxone out into the hands of all of our families.
Now, is there any controversy tied to this drug that you're...
Well, I think it's really about a lack of education, because some people don't know about it. The other issue is that people feel like, is it addictive? Naloxone has no addictive qualities, and so it cannot be abused. And so that's part of the education process we need
to... So some of the misconceptions are that it's a drug in itself that's addictive. But that's just not the case.
That's not the case. Yeah, and actually law enforcement are starting to carry it, paramedics carry it, and so we've really led the nation actually in being a leader around naloxone. And in New Mexico, we allow friends and families to be trained and actually administered naloxone.
And so the... How this relates to the session is that you have a bill for a tax credit, you said?
Actually, this one is an appropriation to the Department of Health, because they have a great harm reduction program, and we could buy more more naloxone with the funds.
So basically just to buy more to administer to people who are having overdoses to stop it.
That's right. Yep.
Well, and I think the other thing we want to talk about was probably the thing that you get to talk about the most is about your bills related to marijuana and marijuana legalization. I guess we could start with the poll that you had that you guys released yesterday that showed a majority of New Mexico voters actually support this.
Yeah, there's a momentous shift across the country, and New Mexico is now not alone. We actually, the poll showed that 52% of New Mexico voters support taxing and regulating marijuana in New Mexico.
So I know that Senator Jerry Ortiz-Pino had a memorial to look into the economic effects of what that legalizing pot might bring. I'm not sure where is that gone anywhere? Has that been killed? Is that?
No, it's still live, and actually it is in Rules Committee, and we hear it's going to be heard this coming Friday. They rolled it over a couple times because of their long agenda, but we expect it to be
Senate
heard
Rules
on Friday.
Is a fun place for a bill to sit for a while. If people who are listening don't know, sometimes bills can languish in there for a couple of weeks. They have a long – not only do they have bills they have to look at, they have to look at every nominee also. So that's kind of a graveyard sometimes, unfortunately.
But that's just a memorial, which are non-binding, right?
Is that that's correct? Right.
And
yeah.
So how long are we from a point where somebody actually introduced and the House actually passes some sort of a ballot initiative like they've had in Washington and Colorado?
Yeah, so I think this is a really smart step, actually, because there's a lot to learn from Washington and Colorado over this next year, and it makes sense for New Mexico to study it this year to see what is the federal response, how are these states going to implement. And so I see
what sort of problems they have in implementing it.
Exactly. And, you know,
I was reading, sorry to cut you off, but I was reading something the other day where they're getting hit with these absurd tax rates, the marijuana distributors in Colorado, because of some obscure federal law that targets drug dealers, basically, like people who are, you know, shipping cocaine into Miami was the example that you used. So.
Yeah, I mean, we're optimistic, but I think there are going to be some obstacles just like that. And so we want to see how the federal government and these state governments are going to start aligning their laws so this can actually be possible. And so I think, you know, again, let's wait a year and see. But to your question, Joey, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a bill be introduced next year or a constitutional amendment and bring it to the voters in 2014.
Right now, New Mexico also has a medical cannabis program. What is the state of that right now? Because a lot of things I've heard are lack of supply, a growing amount of patients. Because every month, the DOH allows new patients, but they haven't really done anything with supply for a few years now. We're at 23 producers and at least 8,000 patients, right?
Yeah, over 8,000. I wouldn't be surprised if we're close to 9,000 now. Yeah, we're really concerned about the lack of supply. Demand is definitely growing, and so the Department of Health needs to make some decisions. I think it's a multifactorial approach. I think it's additional producers. I think it's considering an increase in plant count. I think those would be the two things I'd start with.
Is there anything in the legislature to help with that sort of thing this year?
No, there's only a bill that was introduced by Representative Woolley on the House side.
The criminal background check?
The criminal background checks. My understanding is he's going to go back and amend that bill because, you know, basically it implied that sick patients are criminals, and I think he realized that that was not the intent. So we're waiting to see amendments.
Yeah, but for those who don't know, the bill was Representative Woolley wanted criminal background checks on all of the people who had medical marijuana licenses, and he'd actually kind of pulled something similar on the background check for guns where he wanted the names of everybody in the medical marijuana to be sent to the federal government so they couldn't have guns. So he's using that list in a couple of interesting ways.
Well, actually, what's interesting about that is the ATF says that medical cannabis patients can't own firearms. So that's already something that is a concern on the federal level.
So we have Representative Woolley's bill on that. We have an article in this week's Reporter called Hash Gripe by Peter St. Cyr. But Woolley, yeah, he says in the article that he's gonna pull this back and wants to relook at this because he didn't want to target sick patients per se. But he kind of talks about in this article that wanting to have maybe permits, kind of like concealed carry permits. So if you're pulled over, you can just kind of, and you have pot on you and you're a patient, you can just kind of give your license over, I guess. I don't know. That's
yeah, and you know, I have to say that a lot of what he's proposing really should be done in rules and not in statute. There already is a 24-hour hotline that law enforcement can call to verify that someone is in the medical cannabis program. Patients carry their cards. So I really don't see the need for mandating this in statute.
Were you able to talk with him? Did you?
Yeah, we had a conversation right after the initial bill was introduced, and I really appreciate him in the sense that he really cares. I mean, he cares about the program, and he cares about patients, especially the veterans that are suffering from PTSD.
Yeah, it didn't what did he say about what his concerns were? Because it didn't seem like from this article that he was trying to target the program by any means.
My understanding is that he was concerned that children were accessing marijuana through the medical cannabis program. And, you know, obviously we want to make sure that there's no diversion. This program needs to be regulated well. It's really recognized as the best program in the country. We want to keep it that way. But I'm not sure the data is there to actually indicate that diversion is happening to children. So I'd like to see that data if it's actually true.
Yeah, it's a much stricter program than our friends in California and I was going to say Colorado, but I guess it doesn't really apply.
It's
there.
I hear
in
California,
nobody can hear you, Joey.
What I said was I hear it's similarly strict in Colorado. Maybe not as much, but it's also a much bigger program because they got more people. But California, from what I hear, is it's anything goes, and that's why they've run into so much trouble with the federal government there.
Yeah, I think we're getting off on a tangent again. But real quick, I want to also talk about another bill that you guys are supporting by Representative Emily Kane about reducing the penalties for possession of small amounts, which is basically making it just a civil fine and no jail time, basically.
Yeah, that's right. So basically it makes 4 ounces or less a civil infraction with increasing fines, and up to 8 ounces taking away the jail time, as you mentioned. And that passed out of House Consumer and Public Affairs yesterday afternoon.
And yeah, it's on Tuesday afternoon for people who are listening. And where is it headed to next?
It heads to judiciary next.
So the judiciary, that'll be a fun hearing as well.
Yeah.
That's another one of those busy committees. Why
so,
does this bill need to be?
I mean, basically, our state is spending millions of dollars every year arresting people for having small amounts of marijuana. It's a burden on law enforcement. It's a burden on our jails, for sure, and it's a burden on our courts. So the idea that let's not continue to criminalize people for having small amounts, let them pay a fine, relieve the burden on law enforcement so we can deal with serious crime in the state.
So what would it look like if this bill were to become law and go into effect, would it just be the cop writes you a ticket?
Yeah, that's right. It's a citation, and then you can contest it like you would. It's not like a parking ticket, but the process could be similar, that if you contest it, you go to court. If you don't pay it, then just like any other citation, there's a summons for you to appear.
And are there other states that have similar laws?
Yeah, 15 states. Actually, it started back in 1973. Oregon was the first state. So this is really modest. It's nothing groundbreaking, but it makes sense for New Mexico. It's really smart on crime policy.
So I think we'll keep an eye out on that. And is there anything else that you guys are looking at this year?
Well, the only thing I would just add on that last one is our polling results also showed that 57% of New Mexicans supported this type of measure. So the will of the people is there, and we're hoping our legislators will follow suit.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thank you.
And,
thanks, Matt. Thanks,
I think that
Joey.
We'll be right back talking with Joey about our IPRA, about his IPRA problems with the governor's office, and we'll be right back after this break.
We're back, and I'm Joey Peters, Santa Fe reporter.
I'm Matthew Reichbach, editor at New Mexico Telegram, nmtelegram.com.
And we're going to talk about the latest snafu in Santa Fe Reporter's, or rather my, public records request, dating all the way back to June of last year with the governor's office, and the latest letter from the attorney general to the governor's office that is reiterating that they screwed up on my records request.
Yeah, basically, from what I know from reading it, you wrote.
Well,
just basically go through the timeline real quick.
So back in June, Emailgate broke, and it started with an email. Larry Behrens, the public information officer at the Public Education Department, sending a list of non-union teachers to Jay McCleskey, the governor's top advisor, political advisor, and Keith Gardner, Scott Darnell, both top-level governor's office staffers, and the Secretary of Education designate, Hannah Scandera. Larry sent it from his private email account to their private email accounts, and this kind of opened the door of a, you know, private email network going on in the governor's office
doing public business
like this. Now, Larry had come and said to the press that he was not doing political work. This was simply a response to a public records request, and that I'm not doing any work related to the governor's political action committee. So I put a public records request out, basically naming Gardner's and Scott Darnell's email addresses, their private email addresses that were on that email, on the date that that email was sent. And I chose a few other dates because I didn't want to see just that email, but I wanted to see other emails to see if they would provide them discussing public business. And I chose a date, the date of the Behrens email, because I knew there was something there. And basically, it never came back. It took the governor's office months to respond, and that email never came back. And since then, I filed a complaint with the attorney general's office. The attorney general, Gary King, is charged with enforcing public records laws in New Mexico. Took them about 6 months, but they finally, last month, sent a letter to the governor's office saying, you guys basically messed up with this public records request. Please provide Mr. Peters with all the emails.
And that was a couple weeks ago?
That was a couple weeks ago. So since then, the governor's office sent the attorney general a letter basically saying, we sent Joey Peters everything initially. We weren't holding anything back. Actually, they didn't even say that. They just said, we sent them all the responsible documents. We've told you that many times. We understand that Mr. Peters was looking for this, or was concerned that he didn't get this Behrens email. Had he specified that email in his request, we would have forwarded it on to the Public Education Department. And then they said, they also said this email was forwarded to Secretary Scandera on a Susanna2010.com account. And as you may know, this is what the governor's office is saying, the Susanna2010 emails were stolen, and there's an FBI investigation to look into who stole them. Now, there's many things wrong, in my opinion, with this response. First off, nobody's proven that these emails were stolen. But that's not even the brunt of it. Second off, they...
Even if they were stolen, if they're public records, they still have to provide them.
Yeah, but with their whole... They're saying these emails were intercepted, meaning they never saw them. So what's wrong with that is that they're referring to when Secretary Scandera forwarded Behrens' email to Governor Martinez on her Susanna2010 account. The original email was sent to Scott Darnell's Susanna PAC account and Keith Gardner's Susanna PAC account. The original email here, if you're following me, they did not say that the Susanna PAC emails were stolen, which means Scott and Keith should have access to their Susanna PAC emails. So that's the first major red flag in their argument. The second is that I have to specify the email I'm looking for in a public records request. That's not how public records requests work.
Because basically, if you had to do that, if I had to say, I'm looking for this, so, this specific one, then it could tip them off as to what you're looking
for. So here's Secrecy of State. That's an article in this week's Reporter about this. I'll quote from it. Under state law, requesting a public record does not require saying exactly what you're looking for, in part to avoid tipping off public officials who may be tempted to hide or destroy records. Brian Egolf, state representative of Santa Fe area, liberal Democrat, said, "It strikes me as absurd to take the position that you have to know all the information you're asking for before you ask for it. For them to say they're not going to give it to you because you didn't know the to and the from, that's absurd." So basically,
they wanted you to say exactly which email you're looking for. And under IPRA, if you say, as long as it's not overly burdensome, as long as you're not saying, give me every email sent regarding this subject, yeah, that would be overly broad. But if you're saying, on this date, the email is sent from this account to this account.
Yeah, I chose about 3 or 4 accounts, and we chose 3 dates. Now, they did try to argue that was burdensome, and that's what took them so long. Go to your email. You can search your own email for one, all the emails on one date. It doesn't take long.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't.
I can understand if they need more than 2 weeks, I guess, but they took 2 months to get me back nothing, basically. So
that's where. And you said the Attorney General.
Now the Attorney General sent then, and they sent that letter in February. The governor's office. The Attorney General sent a letter back last week, basically that no. Here it says they're urging the governor's records custodian, Pamela Kaysen, to basically confer with all the people, the 4 top officials that have put on that records request, and solicit from them emails held in their respective Susanna Peck or other private email accounts as identified in my public records request. They're basically reiterating what they said last time. So now that's 2 letters from the AG to the governor's office saying they're not treating this public records request properly.
And it could result in...
The fine for not, for mishandling a public records request, from the day you mishandle it, it's $100 a day. They responded in August, and by the end of February, it's near $20,000 up to. If we had decided to go to court on this, which I guess I won't comment on.
But your lawyer has told you not to. No. So basically that's where this saga that our listeners have heard about before stands, is we're still at a stalemate.
Yeah, it's just back and forth between the Attorney General and the governor's office, and we're kind of at the Reporter are at the middle of it. Now, the Attorney General is running for governor in 2014. If he gets the Democratic nomination, he'll be up against Susana Martinez. Presumably, we're all assuming that she's going to run for re-election.
Nobody's going to run against her or defeat her.
And both King and Martinez have already raised a lot of money. I guess King is presumed. I mean, we're really early here, but right now he's the front runner because he's raised a ton of money,
and he's the only one really who's announced.
And he's been in politics for a while. He's been the Attorney General since 2006.
Yeah, so he's
dad was governor.
He's already facing. I mean, I think we're getting a little bit off on a tangent here, but he's already facing accusations of conflict of interest.
Yeah, conflict of interest in this. And I mean, when we did our Patron Awards on the Weekly Word here, we gave him that award, biggest conflict of interest, for basically investigating the governor on this stuff, but. But his office is charged with enforcing public records law in New Mexico, and This is from his spokesman, Phil Cisneros. He denies that there's any type of political motivation behind how they're handling my records request complaint. And he basically said, you know, the second letter, it's the standard operating procedure, which basically he had said that, you know, when the AG makes a determination and, you know, usually they'll give a good window of time for whoever it is that they've found wrongdoing to respond. And if, you know, like in this case, if the governor's office is digging its heels in, they're going to send another letter. That's standard.
So we'll keep everyone posted on where this goes next.
Yes.
And
I encourage you all to make public records requests for public business on private email accounts at the governor's office.
Well, we'll see if they get a lot from all
because the whole point of this is, yes, Martinez has made orders to stop. Last summer, she made an executive order for state employees to stop doing this stuff, to stop using private accounts. But they've never discussed the content. As far as I know, they've never discussed the content on any of the hundreds of emails that were leaked last summer, a lot of which had lobbyists setting up meetings with, you know, companies and governor's office officials. It had a lot of plans to privatize the rail runner, a lot of stuff that concerns our taxpayer dollars. So the point of this is to, well, A, find out more or try to find more communications like these that happened on private email accounts, and B, get the governor's office to at least discuss the content of some of these, because so far they've said they're stolen, we're not going to discuss it.
Okay, I think we can go ahead and wrap up the discussion of IPRA right here, and we'll get more on that as it comes out.
As it develops. Yeah, so thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week. I'm Joey Peters with The Reporter.
I'm Matthew Reichbach with Mexico Telegram and mtelegram.com.
And sfreporter.com, or check out one of them red drop boxes that says Santa Fe Reporter on it.
We'll see you guys next week.